Happy Passover and welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. This is Yaakov Katz, and you can find us where podcasts can be found. We're a week out of elections in the midst of the Passover holiday. Thanks to the vaccines and the amazing drop in coronavirus infection rates, Israelis are out in the masses, hiking, swimming, eating, and just walking down the street. Traffic is terrible, but I guess that is what happens after people were cooped up at home for the greater part of the last year. Traffic jams, though, aren't only on our streets. In politics, we're also facing something of a jam, and we're not that much better off than we were when we last spoke, just after the March 23rd vote. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu does not have the 61 mandates he wanted on the right, and on the other side, what's being called the change bloc, there's also no 61. For both sides to cross that line, they'll need the support of Arab parties, either inside the coalition or from the outside. Will they do it? Can they do it? And what does that mean for Israel are just some of the topics I'll cover with our guest this week, Mitchell Barak, a veteran political analyst. Mitchell, a pollster, strategic communicator, and messaging expert, is the founder of Kivun, a global survey research and communications firm based in Israel. In the 1990s, he worked with Netanyahu. In the 2000s, he worked with Shimon Peres and Ariel Sharon. In this last round of elections, he worked with Meretz, helping it go from below the threshold to 6 seats, an impressive result for the left-wing party. To finish us off, I'll chat a bit with Tamar Beiri, editor of the Jerusalem Post website, who's been covering for us this past year women's affairs, and especially the unfortunate, actually horrific, rise in domestic violence and sexual abuse. We'll talk about the trend, what COVID has to do with it, as well as one recent case in particular. You'll want to hear what Tamar has to say. Let's begin. Mitchell, great to have you with us on the Jerusalem Post podcast. So you're a veteran campaigner, strategist, pollster, guy who's been around the block. You've worked in the past with Netanyahu. You've met a lot of these different characters and players on the Israeli political landscape over the last couple of decades, I'd say. 3 decades. There you go. Mitchell's pointing, making a 3 gesture to me. In this campaign, though, in election number 4 of the last 2 years, you worked with the Meretz Party, right? You did some work for them. Correct. Can you tell us what that was like? What did you do for those guys?
Well, I actually liked them, believe it or not. I mean, a lot of people in the American and certainly the American religious community don't particularly care for them, but they represent a very important part in Israeli democracy. They have a very important voice, which talks about equality. It talks about democracy, certain social justice issues, which should be important to, you know, a religious Jewish person like myself. So I like them. But they also campaigned the last few elections on not going in with Netanyahu, something which Benny Gantz didn't follow through with. And they didn't have any people who were deserters in their party. And they also don't have anyone who's under investigation there. And I think they have a strong...
That's like a rare occurrence.
Yes, it's very rare. It's the only party, I believe, other than the religious parties, the ultra-Orthodox parties, that didn't have anyone that left and deserted. I think that it's kind of interesting because what's happened in this election, it's very much like the NBA All-Star game, you know, and we love the NBA and it's great. And the All-Star game when we were growing up used to be East versus West. Right. That was a game. And, you know, people who were on the East Coast teams played for the East Coast, who won, they were always dominant team. Then about a few years ago, they started to forget the East and West because the people want to see who's the superstars. So it became team LeBron versus team Durant or team Stephen Curry. Right. And it wasn't a team effort anymore. And I think that's what we're seeing in a lot of elections. And that was one of the difficulties of Meretz, by the way, because Meretz is a party of people that's led by a person. And all the other parties were really these rock star parties, which were led by these personalities, and no one knew anyone else on the list.
Oh, that's a big compliment, calling them rock stars.
Well, not rock stars, but personalities.
Yes,
people
I get it.
Think of themselves as rock stars.
They definitely
or
do.
Potential
yes.
Prime ministers. And these parties really only have a shelf life of however long their leader lasts in politics. I mean, Lieberman has been around for a long time, but the day Lieberman leaves, that party folds. Right. Lapid has done a great job from, you know, starting off with 19 seats, then to 10, then to joining up with Gantz. He's done a fantastic job of building a party, but there's really no personalities. That party doesn't have longevity.
Because Meretz, though, and I see where you're going, Meretz has a real, they're true believers, right? They have a real ideology. They're the true left. That we always talk about the left dying in Israel, but these guys actually believe what they say.
Right. The interesting thing about them, not only have they been around for 30 years, but the last 20, they haven't been in government. So it's really, I like to call them the losers that actually vote for that party, because they know that party is most probably not going to go in the government. Whereas everyone's strategically thinking, how are they going to get a seat at the government table? The people that are voting for them are voting because they want their voice heard in the Knesset and in the Israeli democracy, and they want them to participate.
So they want a voice heard, not necessarily a voice that's influential, though, because
correct.
If they're in the opposition for 20 years, they're not really doing that much or affecting that much change.
Well, you still have to talk about these issues of democracy, of equality. They have an issue with, you know, what's going on in the West Bank, in Judea and Samaria.
Is there something happening there? Because based on this last election, you wouldn't know.
You're right. Based on the last, 15 or 20 years, you wouldn't know that anything is going on. But the last I checked, it's being administered by a military governor appointed by the IDF. Now, they have different areas, A, B, C, it's the alphabet areas, whatever they are. But at the end of the day, you know, in the whole month of June, Prime Minister Netanyahu spent time talking about annexing those areas, some of them, all of them, part of them. So there is what's going on. There is an opinion that says this should really be a debate, and we really have to deal with the Palestinian issue.
Right. Now, Meretz, throughout the campaign, was teetering on the threshold for a period of time, right? It wasn't clear, were they going to pass, were they not going to pass? In the end, they passed and they got six seats,
which is
beyond, I think, what they expected.
Correct.
Obviously, to your credit, because you worked on that campaign.
Well, let's not exaggerate.
Right. But what was it? What gave them that win?
Well, so the problem was is that they really weren't able to run an issue-oriented campaign, meaning the polling showed us that people have been voting for them for many years. It's sort of like the old Maftal, the National Religious Party, meaning there are people that voted for the Maftal because it was a way of life or because their fathers and grandfathers voted for that party. And they vote for that party no matter what. That stopped Naftali Bennett. One of his, I think, greatest failures was that, you know, the National Religious Party has died. The Maftal doesn't really exist. It doesn't even really exist on paper. So people have been voting for Meretz for generations for the past 30 years, and they're voting because it represents a certain value of theirs. The problem became not in that we didn't see support in the polls. The problem became when the media was actually saying that they're not going over the threshold. And then the media went from reporting on polls, even though the statistical significance of it was really insignificant. They went from reporting it to being an active player, trying to push Meretz out of the campaign, trying to get them to leave, and trying to, you know, convince other people that it would be throwing out a vote.
And this was because the media that, let me go with your narrative here, wanted to coalesce around a single candidate who would stand the best chance of ousting Netanyahu?
Well, it did seem that there are some in the media who would be to the left, but they felt that it was a wasted vote to the bloc. And the fact is that it's 3.5% to get over the threshold. And the margin of error...
3.25.
Oh, 3.25. And the margin of error in each of these polls is about 4.5%.
Right.
So you're talking about an online panel, which is not a reliable, you know, sample to begin with, because it's the same 100,000 people in Israel that have been, you know, bombarded with party, you know, advertisement and party polls by the various pollsters. But the difference between 3.25% and 4.5% on a 500 or 600 person poll is like 17 votes versus 25. So for a handful of votes, they're making headlines that Meretz is not over or Gantz is not going over the threshold. And I think it came to the point where it became not fair because it's not responsible to report that way. And then even Razi Barkai, who's one of the famous, you know,
radio hosts,
personalities,
right,
and commentators, you know, the first question was always, you're not getting over the threshold. Do you realize you're not relevant anymore? And then when are you going to drop out? A party that's in the Knesset and in the Knesset for 30 years doesn't drop out because of some media polls. And then blaming them that Netanyahu is going to stay in if they don't drop out and they're going to waste votes.
But then Meretz cried the great gewalt, right? Mm-hmm. Which is Yiddish for alarm.
Correct.
And the gewalt worked.
Well, it worked. First of all, you can't run a campaign when you're fighting for your existence, even if that's not based on reality. You can't fight for your you can't fight and run the campaign based on principles, based on, you know, policies that you've done and things you want to do. The Gewalt worked, and there's a reason it worked, because people really want to party in. Meaning people actually said, whereas they may have freed up their other vote for another party at that point, they said, okay, we really need to keep them in the Knesset. The Gewalt will only work on something you want to save.
Right. Well, you have to be a Gewalt for that to work. So, you know, one thing that's also interesting about Meretz, though, is for a number of years now, especially in under Netanyahu, who's been prime minister consecutively for the last 12, we've constantly heard that the left is dead in Israel, right? The Palestinian issue, we joked before about how is there even a Palestinian issue, but yes, there is. But the social justice issues that they've always focused on, as the government has become more conservative, more religious, more nationalistic, it's all been pushed aside. But interestingly, in these last elections, 6 seats to Meretz, 7 seats to Labor. Labor, just a couple months ago, was expected to die completely, right? Can we make an argument that maybe there's a left resurgence in Israel, or is that jumping it?
Well, I think there might. First of all, I don't speak on behalf of Meretz. Let me, you know, make that clear. I advise
as an analyst.
As an analyst. So first of all, yes, there is. There does seem to be both the Labor Party coming back, also in the form of a personality of Meirav Micheli, representing those liberal values, which are very similar to Meretz values. So I think there are things of talking about what's going on in the peace process, especially now that there seems to be an opportunity in that we're getting peace throughout the world. So now we don't have to take as much of a chance, and now maybe a real opportunity to do something, but we haven't dealt with this issue. We keep, you know, every government keeps kicking the can down and hoping they can create more facts on the ground and just make, you know, forget about it. Well, the problem doesn't go away. It certainly doesn't go away with the Biden administration, and the social justice issues are coming back into play. Now, at the same time, I think there's another key factor here is that Lieberman, I wouldn't call him a party on the left, but he ran an anti-Haredi and anti-ultra-Orthodox campaign. That goes into it also, meaning there's a large segment of society which just finds themselves as secular, and even religious people like myself, maybe like you, maybe like others, that says, hey, it's time to get the Jewish religion out of politics.
Right. Recalibrate. Create a new balance.
Right. We shouldn't be forcing people not to sell chametz on Pesach. If someone wants to go out, it was ridiculous the last few years. You have guards at hospitals, you know, making sure that
one of my kids was born on the holiday of Pesach, on like the third or fourth day.
Okay.
Right. We wanted to get some normal food. This is 14 years ago. Okay. My mother had to smuggle food in. I'm not going to go into detail here on the podcast how she got the food into the hospital. But I mean, like, we're religious people, observant. We're not eating chametz on Pesach, right?
Right.
And she had to literally smuggle it in under her clothing to get it into the hospital. That's crazy.
So the majority of people in the hospital at that point are not religious and don't care about it. The 30% Arabs that are there in Jerusalem and the...
Let them eat whatever they want
right,
to eat.
Right, right, right. That's the point. And let people get married. There's a real problem in Israel that people cannot get married here. It's a crazy situation, but we inherited from the Ottoman Empire. But only the Rabbanut can determine who's Jewish and then who can get married. So you certainly have 300,000 Israelis of Russian descent that aren't defined Jewish. They have no way in the world to get married in this country.
Right.
They
no,
can't.
It's a travesty in my opinion as well. But just getting back to politics for a moment, because we could talk a lot about the religion and state issues as well. You've worked with Bibi in the past, back in the 90s.
He hasn't changed.
Okay. So
and his wife hasn't changed
so
either.
Here's my question to you right now. Bibi, right, is short of the 61. He's got 59. And 59 is only if Bennett joins him, right?
Right.
Without Bennett, he's down to 52. So how stressed out is it on Balfour Street right now, where the prime minister's official residence is? Like, what's the level there? Do you want to go close to that place? You want to stay far away? What's it like?
No, you always want to stay far away. Uh-huh. The man is always stressed. The man is always working. I don't think he, you know, takes time out to see a movie, to call a friend, to go watch a game. You know, this is not someone who relaxes. This is not someone who hangs out. And
doesn't sit back with a t-shirt, pair of shorts,
correct. He doesn't
a beer and a old movie.
He doesn't decompress. As the CEO of Pfizer said, the man was obsessive, calling him at 3 o'clock in the morning, Israel time, to find out the vaccines. He has no time. You know, it doesn't, whatever needs to get done, he's always working. So for him, this is a bump on the highway here. This is, you know, he'll figure it out. Just because he doesn't have, he would prefer now to have 61. If he had 61 with Bennett, he would probably sail through much easier. But the fact that he doesn't means he's just got to go, you know, time is always on his side, because the more he waits, the less, and they don't have a government, means he might have a chance to either form a government or to go to other.
So you don't think he's pressured right now?
Oh, he's always pressured.
No, but I mean, like, not extraordinarily. It's just it's more of the routine. He's confident he'll find a solution to this.
You know, the man is always pressured. He's never relaxed, and this is just another thing. Look at the past, you know, 5 or 6 or 7, 10 years that he's been prime minister. He's always goes from crisis to crisis. Coalition crisis, a crisis with the U.S. or something else. You know, when I worked for Ariel Sharon, so it was really interesting. So he's relaxed. He's even keeled. That's the guy you want getting the phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning. That's the guy you want making the decision of whether to send the army in, what to do with the Mossad, and so forth. We had an interview. He had an interview with, I think it was the Telegraph, one of the British papers, and it was the Knesset vote was going to decide that his government would fall. And these two guys came in, it was in the Prime Minister's residence on Balfour, into the office there in the back, and they said, Mr. Prime Minister, you know, you have a government crisis. You know, you didn't want to cancel the interview. He says, no, why should I be concerned? And he spent the first 20 minutes talking about his farm, and I remember talking about breeding sheep and how he needed to get the spotted sheep were not good, and he needed to get the black sheep and the white sheep together and find a way to breed them better. And he was relaxed. He was relaxed. Totally relaxed. And Netanyahu is always hyper, always calling people. Everything is urgent, even when it's not urgent. So now, for sure, it's urgent. But, you know, he will always thinks that he can find a way out.
What are the next steps? Can he find a way out? His options are pretty limited. On the one hand, he could try to get some defectors, right, from the other parties.
That always works. And that's changed in the last number of years. I mean, there's no even, there used to be honor among thieves, right? Today, there's no honor among members of Knesset. You can change parties. You can change twice. You can change your politics. You can do whatever you want, depending on what position you
get.
Well,
I mean, look what we've seen. We saw Benny Gantz run 3 elections that he's not going to sit with Netanyahu.
Correct.
And then he went and sat with Netanyahu.
Correct. And right. We have Hauser and Hendel, the famous people brought in by Bougie Yalom, that basically caused like 2 or 3 elections to happen. First, they wouldn't give Gantz the 61 because they wouldn't go in with the Arab party. And then they bolted from Yalom and Lapid to go with Gantz. And then they bolted again to call new elections and then to go with Tsar. So, you know, and then they have the chutzpah to call their party Derech Eretz. You know, they're lacking decency. No. To call it Derech Eretz is kind
of... It's a loose definition. But so if he doesn't get the defectors, the other option is to get Ra'am, which is basically a party led by Mansour Abbas, a very Islamist Arab party, quite conservative. Some might even say extreme, and to get them not necessarily to sit in Netanyahu's government, but to at least vote from the outside to support him swearing in and getting that government, that minority government, approved. But before you talk about that, I mean, zoom out for 1 second. There's a change taking place in Israel. All sides of the political map are talking about the legitimacy of having Arabs sit in the coalition or support a coalition in one way or another. That's a good thing.
It's amazing that Israel actually looks like a non-racist democracy. You know, it's amazing because even in the last election, Gantz and Lapid said, we will not go with the Arabs. You know, they said, what kind of democracy says that? Meaning, where do you say that 20% of the population is not legitimate to sit in a government? So that has definitely changed. You know, I like to say that Americans and Israelis, they love to say Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. That really doesn't mean anything. What they really need to say, we need to switch around the words and say Israel is the only Middle Eastern democracy. Because when you change it, then you have the horse trading, then you have the defectors, then you have the tribalism that we're seeing. And that's definitely what's going on now. Now, one of the things that I think Netanyahu. So, yes, that's playing out now that the Arab parties are actually, they may actually participate. And that will be a huge leap if they get involved.
And by the way, you know who we have to thank for that?
Netanyahu.
Because But by the way, it didn't come from a place of, you know, suddenly I really I like what you said before. I want to be more democratic. We want to be more accepting and tolerant of the 20% minority in Israel. It came from, how can I survive politically? But as they say in the Talmud, Mashalo lishma balishma, right, was done not for the sake of heaven, can turn into what's done for the sake of heaven. That's a classic example right here.
Yes, Netanyahu also, I think, is credited with the highest turnout among the Arab sector. Not this election, but by being racist in one of the campaigns and saying they're coming out to vote in droves and we have to do it.
That was the 2015.
He actually motivated them to organize, you know, into a party and then get so many seats. So he definitely is, you know, gaining when it comes to including the Arabs more, but from a negative standpoint, not because he's trying to do it as of kind of, you know, an effect of what he's trying to cause. Now, I've polled in the Arab community for the Konrad Adenauer Foundation. We've done serious polls over the last 5 or 6 years. The majority of them either want to join the government directly or support it from the outside. There is up to 70 or 80% support, about 40 and 40, either to join the government, either as a minister or take a Knesset committee and vote directly for it, or support it from the outside, meaning not be against it. The problem up until now is really with the Jewish parties, with the that say, you know, we don't want to rely on the Arabs, the Arab votes, and the Arab votes, you know, when you say you need 61 out of 120, it's not really true. You need 61 out of 105 or 110, you know, whatever it is, minus the Arab parties. So that could be an interesting, you know, change that takes place, and I think a welcome one, because it's time that Israel, you know, acts like a democracy. The nation-state law is an issue for many of them and for many Israelis, too. Defining, you know, Israel as a Jewish state is not a problem. That's been done. But there was no mention of any kind of equality in there for all the citizens.
The Bennett scenario here, right? Mm-hmm. You have a, on the other side, what they like to call the change block, mm-hmm. right? The people who want to bring down Netanyahu. How does that play out in your view? I mean, can you really have a scenario where you have 7 or 8 parties come together, Arabs, right wing, left wing, Meretz on the one hand, Bennett on the other side? Can that really work?
Well, in the words of Isaiah, the great prophet, I think that, you know, the wolf can lie with the lamb. You know, that can certainly take place. You know, how long will it last? That's the question. But there does seem, I mean, we have enough problems going on here at this point with Corona, with the economy, and with people that just want to move on from Netanyahu. I mean, even people that say, and he's done some great things. But the fact is even between the last election and now, getting Israelis vaccinated and bringing peace agreements with Bahrain, you know, and the United Arab Emirates, he should be sailing in at 42, 45 seats. Like, those are amazing achievements.
Right.
And he's
but
not.
He didn't.
Right, he's not, because people are tired of it, and people are have fatigue from Netanyahu.
But even with that fatigue, Mitchell, he got 30 seats. The second party just after him, Lapid, 17.
Right.
He's almost double.
Right. So you know what they said? There was a great joke in the time of Begin that the Hebrew University wanted to understand about, you know, they did some experiments and they wanted to, you know, remove half a person's brain to see what would happen. And when the man woke up, all he could say was Begin. Begin. People do not think. Now, that's not to say that Likud supporters are not intelligent and don't have a brain, but they will go with Netanyahu, and many of them are Sephardic, interestingly enough. They're from lower segments of society, they're Sephardic, and they want a strong leader, a strong Jewish leader with a Jewish identity. That's what speaks to them so much about Netanyahu. The fact that Netanyahu can travel the world and he can be best friends with Trump and best friends with Putin and go to Congress and really be an international player and get vaccines before everyone else. There's a certain Jewish pride that he gives those Likud voters and those people that vote for him, and that's what they want time after time.
And that's why they keep on voting.
They keep on voting, and the scandals don't matter.
How do these people eventually believe that change is possible? What needs to happen? I mean, I've spoken to so many people over the last few years who say, you're right, BB, it's enough. It's enough. His time has come. But who can do it? Who else is out there? Show me someone who can do it.
Right now, there really doesn't seem to be someone that is the, you know, unifying candidate against him, because the other thing he's very good at is taking anyone that has a chance and making sure that they don't develop into a leader and making sure that there isn't a good leadership in Likud. You know, the other thing is that, you know, he's not so committed to the right wing ideology, meaning, you know, he was the guy who was the finance minister for the disengagement from Gaza. leaving the government as finance minister only a month before, meaning all of
after
the
voting repeatedly correct. In favor of
correct. And if someone was really committed to a right-wing ideology, he would have stepped away after the first election, the second election, third election, and say, I can't do this. I want to give it to someone else in my party. I want to make sure that it stays in a right-wing government. But that's not his intention.
Does he have an ideology today?
His ideology, I think his ideology is Benjamin Netanyahu. It's that he is the leader, the supreme leader of Israel. He is the best person capable for the job, and he is the only one that can do it. And he will do anything, including calling second or third or fourth elections and playing chicken with anyone else who wants to see whether they can beat him and, you know, wait to call elections again.
It's interesting. He's been awfully quiet since elections, right? Now, you know, like I do, when he's in election campaign mode, you can't go look anywhere or turn on a TV or a radio correct. Without hearing him. He's on the morning show, the morning TV show, the afternoon radio show, the night TV news. Mm-hmm. He's interviewing with every religious website and Haredi mm-hmm. radio show. I mean, he's everywhere. Since elections, nothing.
Right.
Where is he? What's he doing?
Well, the first thing I think you should mention at this point is he's out there all the time, but in between elections, he doesn't give interviews anymore.
No, never.
He doesn't give interviews to the newspaper. The prime minister used to give an interview to the Jerusalem Post, I think,
every,
twice a
by
year.
By the way, every twice a year. I was right. just talking about this with Herb Kanin, our veteran diplomatic mm-hmm. analyst. We used to get an interview every Rosh Hashanah mm-hmm. and every Yom HaTzimut, every Independence correct. Day, right? You get like the pulse of the nation.
Right.
12 years he hasn't done that.
Right. Haaretz also, he stopped doing it there. He stopped doing TV interviews. He doesn't do press conferences. He never does press conferences. If he does a press conference, it's usually with another world leader that come, and they have a canned question from one of the journalists. He doesn't answer questions, even like Biden and Trump do. You can criticize them. One says whatever he wants. The other reads off note cards. But he doesn't even do that. Like, he doesn't communicate. And I think I was disappointed personally that, you know, as soon as they called elections, he was in every Israeli television studio. They should have said, hey, we're not going to interview you. All of a sudden, elections, you're going to come in? No, sorry. You got to come. This is a relationship thing. You know, they just gave him, you know, a platform to say what he wanted. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. He's been quiet. You know, I think he's waiting to see where it goes. I think there's a certain level of shock, probably, that he doesn't have the 61 that he thought he would have. You know, he sent some people out in the Likud to talk about possibly, you know, getting with the Arab parties or not. He certainly, the whole campaign he did in the Arab sector was not really to get votes. It was to make them kosher, if you will, to, you know, to prepare the public that they may be in the coalition in some way, either on the outside or somehow on the inside and right. doing that.
That, I mean, that's one of his great gifts, right, is that he's always thinking a couple steps ahead.
Well, it's not just a couple steps ahead. You know, I one of my favorite classes when I studied political science at George Washington University was political psychology. And I had a great professor, Gerald Post, and he wrote different profiles of leaders. And he fits in to the classic narcissistic leader, okay? And one of the things I always remembered about a narcissistic leader, which when I started working for Netanyahu, I realized this, is that, first of all, a narcissistic leader never sees assistants, advisors. He doesn't see them as people. He thinks every idea is his, and he doesn't recognize them or their contributions. The other thing is a narcissistic leader can change his opinion or policy 180 degrees and doesn't ever see a contradiction in what he did in changing. And you see that with Netanyahu all the time. Right. He changes. He's against something, totally against it, and then he's supporting
it. It's an incredible journey that he's definitely had over the last 12 years. Just briefly, what's your prediction?
Oh, I never predict anymore. I mean, I was the guy who said there wouldn't be a second election, there wouldn't be a third election, there wouldn't be a fourth election.
So say there will be a fifth election, maybe it'll be the opposite.
Yeah, maybe. I think we're going to have to, it's definitely a difficult, for Lapid, it's going to be very difficult. Look, the game will change once someone gets the mandate to form the government. And I think a surprise here maybe.
Which happens next week when President Rivlin is supposed to give right. one Knesset right. member that mandate.
Correct. If it's not Netanyahu, then it changes the game. It means that someone else is now tasked to form a government, and all they need is 61 seats. And if that happened, and I were in the, you know, Haredi Aguda Israel party, I would be really concerned, Shas party too, that the train may be leaving the station, and that means that the yeshivas are not going to get funded. that yeshiva students might get drafted in a way that they wouldn't agree to, and that there will be legislation which will not be favorable to them. And all of this work that the housing minister has done, Litzman, might not continue.
So you would say maybe join whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, the Shas doesn't have the guts at this point to break with the Lithuanian, you know, the Agudat Yisrael party. It has to be the Aguda party first. Shas would come after. And the good thing about them is their voters don't care. As soon as the rabbis say, it's okay, that's what we're doing, they're fully behind
it. And by the way, traditionally, it's important to mention, historically, Shas definitely has sat in left-wing governments as well, right? They go with the government.
Yes, they've done it. I believe they did it only twice, if I'm not mistaken.
When Rabin was prime minister?
They did it with Rabin, and they did it also with, was it with Olmert that they did it? That they went without the Lithuanians, and I don't think they would do it again. I don't think they'll be the first ones to do it again, but either of them can do that. I mean, they have to see. The question is, how are they going to sit with Lieberman? Lieberman is a real enigma here because besides running an anti-Haredi campaign, he helped elect, you know, with Aryeh Deri. He opposed Ofer Berkovich, who was the secular candidate for the mayor of Jerusalem, and put in Moshe Leon, who personally I think is a great mayor, and I've had great experiences with him.
I think
him,
he's doing a good job, too.
With my kids' schools and other things, you know, with a ultra-Orthodox city council. So he knows how to work with the Haredim. It's not that he doesn't know how to work with them. But, you know, he took this as a campaign thing. So the question is can they, you know, find some way to do it? Because I don't see Yair Lapid saying goodbye to Lieberman to join the ultra-Orthodox. But we may see it. It'll depend on what is the government tasked to do? What are the guidelines of the government, the Kaveh Yisod? What's the foundations of the government, and how are they going to operate?
Well, first, let's get a government, right?
That would be the first thing.
That would be the first thing. Mitchell Barak, great to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be at the Jerusalem Post.
So, Tamar, great to have you on the podcast. We're talking because of this recent uptick in domestic violence and rape, sexual abuse, all happening. It seems, according to the data, and experts are talking about the fact that this has to do with coronavirus, that the virus and the fact that people are more at home, more susceptible to violence, to abuse, and things of that sort. But we're speaking specifically, not just that's a general trend, but there have been a number of horrific cases in recent weeks. One of them is Yerin Scherf. Why don't you tell us a bit about who this guy was, what he's suspected of doing, and the terrible, I think, at least, decision that the state originally made, which was then corrected. So who is Yerin Scherf and what did he allegedly do? And let's just, for the sake of this conversation, he's a suspect still in the case.
Yes, he is the alleged rapist of a 13-year-old girl in a coronavirus hotel, specifically for teens, if I am not mistaken, for troubled teens. He was 19 years old when the event happened. That should have been in about January or February, if I'm not mistaken. And what happened was he was constantly close to her. They have these sort of counselors in the hotel. They kept telling him to stay away from her. He did not listen.
And this is a hotel for people who are being quarantined because of COVID.
Correct. Right. Yes. And he kept getting close to her. And what ended up happening, allegedly, is that he strangled her. He raped her twice. And he provided her with drugs, alcohol. This is a 13-year-old, mind you.
Right.
And when it came to light, there was a lot of shakeup in Israeli society over it. You know, it got a lot of attention because they were holed up together. This is a hotel. They were stuck together, just like what's happening all around the country, all around the world right now because of the pandemic. And in this specific situation, he took complete advantage of this minor, and it's this just horrifying situation.
So the police investigate. It comes to the prosecution, which is meant to decide on the charge that is to be brought against this alleged rapist, before to be brought to court. And he wasn't charged originally with rape, right?
No, he was charged with forbidden sexual relations, including sexual harassment, threats, sexual assault, supplying illegal substances, including drugs and alcohol, to a minor. But none of those is actually rape, legally, right, in a court of law.
And the reason was, apparently, she might have not told the exact truth of what her exact age was. Maybe she said she was a little older, and therefore, there started to be a whole conversation right in the media and in the public domain of how could someone who even says she's 14 or 15 even give consent? This girl is actually 13.
Correct. Right? On a legal level, she cannot. That's been made clear in Israel. Also abroad, the legal age of consent is internationally wavering between 16 and 18 for women. And in this specific case, the defendant's lawyer said that, and I quote, 13-year-olds give consent all the time these days. Which is so shocking to hear, you know?
Considering that I have a 13-year-old at home, I am quite shocked. But then there was a public uproar, right? And the there were protests and demonstrations, and outside of the prosecution office in Tel Aviv, there were thousands of emails that were sent. It became a big uproar, and the prosecution changed and altered the original indictment and charge sheet and added rape to it.
Correct.
Right? Yes. And that happened just a few days ago. So what Yaron Scherf shows in my mind, right, and we actually wrote the Jerusalem Post editorial earlier this week on this topic, is, you know, it's one thing to find the bad guys, right, or alleged bad guys. It's another thing to apprehend them. It's another thing to bring charges against them. But the prosecution has to know how to bring the right charge. I mean, it seems to me to be ridiculous here. Like, what were they originally thinking? What was going through these people's minds?
Right. It's absolutely impossible to know how it got to that circumstance. But the public uproar did what it should have. And that's the value of, right, the public's opinion, the public's ability to protest and so on and so forth. But in this specific case, I think it demonstrates something that we're seeing a lot, specifically in the fields of sexual abuse and domestic abuse, is this sort of miscommunication between, you know, different branches of government and law. It's something that we're constantly seeing in the government. For example, there's zero communication between different ministries about what they consider illegal and to what extent. So in the case of domestic abuse, for example, this comes to light in situations where the welfare ministry does not see somebody as having the right to certain levels of assistance after experiencing certain levels of domestic abuse, while, like, on the legal side, on the judiciary side, they're seen as much worse, or vice versa. It's very often the opposite. And I think this is a very clear example of just this total lack of communication on what each thing is. Definitions are missing here
in Israel when it comes to these issues. But, you know, in addition to the Scherf case, we have three suspects were arrested in March for allegedly gang raping a 16-year-old. Four suspects were arrested in February for the alleged gang rape of a 13-year-old. Another three were arrested in relation to the rape of a 10-year-old girl during a burglary down south. Five other men were arrested in December for the alleged rape of a 17-year-old. And there was Israel's most infamous case last year, right? 11 suspects arrested in September for the alleged gang rape of a 16-year-old at the Red Sea Hotel in Eilat. And now we have a story just the other day of a number of men who also gang raped a woman, also apparently handicapped, right? Yes. In the back of a van somewhere up north in the galley. What the hell is going on here? Where is this? I mean, is it that we're just more aware? Is it that these cases are coming out more than they did in the past? Or are the experts, like, what are people saying? How are they explaining this terrible trend that we're seeing?
I mean, on the one hand, to some extent, it's all of the above. We're seeing a definite rise in sexual violence throughout the country. And it's very interesting to see it specifically in situations of gang rape. I mean, it's not interesting, it's horrifying, because gang rape doesn't happen at home. When we're looking at sexual abuse and domestic abuse, specifically during a pandemic, we expect everything to be happening in this closed circle, in this tightly knit tension.
Because people are stuck at home and that's what happens.
And all that jazz, right. Yeah. It's kind of a logical progression here. But in gang rapes, we're seeing them happening outside. This last sexual assault, this last alleged rape that you were just discussing of the disabled minor, that happened after she had been kidnapped and driven far away. So we're seeing just a general uptick in all of these gang rapes. On top of that, there's a lot more public awareness. That's for sure.
Which is a very good thing.
Which is a very good thing, because public awareness brings change at the end of the day. The Eilat gang rape, that really brought the public's attention back to what's happening. Gang rapes were high before. Yes, they have risen with COVID-19, but this was happening prior as well. And bringing it to the forefront perhaps will cause more movement. But for now, we're not seeing anything too harsh, at least within the government, for example, to any movements for change.
So one of the changes that's been discussed is, and Tamar Zandberg, who's one of the Knesset members with the Meretz party, has brought this up also recently, is establishing a special court in Israel for sexual violence, right? Yeah. Which I think might make sense, right? You still would need the prosecution to know what charge to bring against whoever that alleged attacker is, which wasn't, unfortunately, the case in the Yarin Scherf instance when they, thankfully, they changed it. But what are your thoughts about that? Would that be effective as people are pinning their hopes to something like that? That would require legislation, obviously, and judicial reform.
Right.
Can that make a difference?
I mean, can it make a difference? Yes. But I think the solution is an immediate one for a long-term issue. At the end of the day, what we want is consensus, and we want people who have committed crimes to be brought to justice. If we're just having this, you know, one centralized area that will take care of it, that will provide immediate relief. But in the long term, it will not create the consensus that we need in order for all courts to know how to deal with all of these circumstances, right? So I'm not sure that this is the best solution. It is definitely an immediate one that could bring
and things. And what other solutions are being spoken about? Is it just more awareness, more education, more
talking awareness and about- more education is always a good way to start. But it's much beyond that. On a interpersonal level, during the COVID pandemic, it's so important to communicate with one another. We don't know what's happening in other people's units, in households. Now that the lockdown is kind of getting released, it's a bit easier to be in touch with one another. But nevertheless, people are still holed up at home with their children, with parents, with potential abusers. People that we're close to, we might not even know, might be abused, might be abusing. And if we're not seeing them, we're not in touch as much. It's harder to notice, and it's harder to get the warning signs and get the people we care about help. Because on top of each person getting themselves help, which is also very important, it's very important to see that other people need help too, because they might not know that they need it. And so in that situation, it's very important to be in touch with people. Teachers have kids on Zoom, turn on the cameras and so on and so forth in meetings and so on. But on a larger scale, it's very, very, very important to create dialogue and communication, both societally and politically, because there's still no consensus. And when there's no consensus, it creates a balagan, it creates a total mess. And people don't know how to treat these cases.
One of the other things I remember from just reporting that we've done here at the paper is that some of these nonprofit organizations, like the Association for Rape in Israel and other organizations like that, which are meant to help victims of sexual abuse, have lost a lot of funding in recent year, and over specifically the last year, without a state budget. It's already been more than a year without a state budget because of our political deadlock. They're not able to get the same funding that they used to get, which is hurting their ability to be able to help people.
It's become a massive, massive issue. In December, VITSO, the world, I want to say
women's organization.
Yes. VITSO reached its deadline for the governmental funding for its crisis centers for families that seek welfare after experiencing domestic abuse. These homes that are made for women and their children when they're...
Shelters.
These shelters, yes. And from then on, they're running on what little funds they're able to get. But they're not getting enough. Like you said, the Association of Rape Crisis Centers in Israel, they're operating on what they've got. But when these programs aren't funded, people in crisis are not receiving the support that they need. Now, this is also partially due to the issue of a state budget that's not coming in. It's also something that could have been prevented prior, because before the coronavirus pandemic, before this became an issue to this extent, a budget was allocated to domestic abuse and sexual abuse prevention within the welfare ministry for these programs, and only one-fifth of it has actually been transferred.
Just another sad example and consequence of our political deadlock, which we tend to mostly focus in the first part of this podcast, is actually on that same topic, right? Of what's going to be with the coalition? Is it going to be Bibi? Is it going to be Bennett? Is it going to be Lapid or someone else? But these are the real life consequences when the government fails to provide the services and the budgets that it's meant to provide its citizens. And there are people who are hurting, who are not getting the services and the help that they need. And you have these people who are perpetrating these horrific crimes, which also needs to come to an end. So, Tamar, thanks a lot for being with us. Thanks for sharing and spotlighting, putting a spotlight on this real terrible trend. We hope that, you know, more awareness, like you mentioned, can make a difference.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your holiday and see you again next week.